broadband internet service providers in Real Simple Syndication are proud to bring you
Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night.
Thank you very much for listening to Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night. I am going to introduce the wonderful Carlin.
And I will introduce to you Jordan.
And today we are going to be taking care of the very first Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night fan selection, Safe.
Thank you, fans.
Thank you very much. This movie was actually selected by Chuck Durfee. And Chuck, I'm sorry, man, if I'm mispronouncing your last name. And also Greg Stifler.
Nice.
Yeah, so the two people actually independently said, hey, we would love to hear you guys talk about Safe. Hey, if anybody else wants to jump in and recommend movies for us, we would be more than glad to watch the movies and let you know what we think. Mm-hmm. It's pretty easy to do that. You could come to our website, just comment on any one of our posts and let us know. Also, we'll be running polls of different selections that people had to see what you want to watch next. So, yeah. And another thing, if you ever want to just post it on our Facebook page, you're more than able to do that. Do a search for Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night on Facebook, and we should pop up, and you can go ahead, like us there, and then leave a comment, and we'd be more than glad to take a look at any movie, as long as it is streaming on Netflix.
And we would also always love it for people to give us ratings and reviews on iTunes. Helps us out.
It would help us out immensely. Also, if you want to send us an email, let us know what you're thinking. And if you have any rebuttals to our reviews, please feel free to email us, and we can go ahead and record those in a special question and answer session, and we'd be more than glad to post that for you.
So this is our first fan pick, and it is Safe.
It is.
You want to give the stats?
I will go ahead and give the stats because I am the stat man.
Stat man.
So the Netflix description of this movie reads as following: a former cage fighter comes to the aid of a 12-year-old girl kidnapped by ruthless triad gangsters. Before the rescue is over, the pair will go up against not only her abductors, but also the Russian mafia and a bunch of corrupt New York cops.
Everyone is corrupt in this movie.
Pretty much everybody is the bad guy in this movie.
Except Jason Statham.
Yes. It was released in 2012, so it's a pretty recent movie, all things considered. It was directed by Boaz Yakin. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
I think it's important to point out at this moment that Boaz Yakin did the film Fresh.
He did Fresh.
Which was a good film. Uh-huh. About a kid who was basically trying to get back at some gangsters. And he was setting them up, basically like a game of chess against one another. That's a good film. But then he also did Dirty Dancing, Havana Nights.
Yes. He's done a lot of interesting movies. Death in Love is another one that he did, which I haven't seen that one, so I couldn't really comment on it. Remember the Titans was one that he did for Disney. And it was actually a pretty decent little movie. Yeah. And another one was A Price Above Rubies, which was one that I believe he wrote and directed that one as well. So you mentioned the major actor in this movie, Jason Statham.
The only one who matters.
Yes, really. If I just listed off his movies, everybody would know what they are. But
and they're all the same.
They're all the same. Yeah, pretty much. Parker, Death Race, Crank. There you go.
Yeah.
That's his entire filmography in just three selections.
Probably the only film I can think of he's been in that was a little bit different was The Italian Job, because he wasn't beating people up as much.
No. And also, the Italian Job was an interesting movie because it was made to clear out a lot of people's contracts.
Oh.
Yeah, like Edward Norton appeared in that movie. Mm-hmm. And the only reason he appeared in that movie was because he was contracted for one more movie and he just wanted to get out of the contract.
I thought it was a good film, though.
Yeah, it was a good film. He kind of phoned that performance in, though, if you look at his other work. But getting back to Safe, the 12-year-old girl is played by Catherine Chan. And she's done not a lot of other work. I mean, she's only got three or four credits to her name. One is a Chinese TV show called Weeds, I don't think I've seen that. I don't know if it's available in the United States. And then also she's got a short film to her credit called Aftershock. It also some of the more famous names in this movie, Chris Sarandon, who was in
Fright Night.
Yeah, Fright Night.
I love Chris Sarandon.
The Nightmare Before Christmas, mm-hmm. Princess Bride. He's been in a lot of great stuff.
Yeah, he's pretty great.
He's probably the most pedigreed actor in the entire movie.
Definitely.
Robert John Burke, which, ironically enough, he was in Confessions of a Dangerous Mind.
Oh, there you go.
There you go. He's also in Dust Devil and Kidnapped. And James Hong, who, if you have ever seen Kung Fu Panda, then you're familiar with his voice. He plays the panda's father, who is a goose. He's also in South Beach Academy and Black Widow. And then another actor who had a big role in this was Anson Mount, who was in SEAL Team 6, All the Boys Love Mandy Lane, and he's also done a stint on Law and Order. So this film was released by Lionsgate, and was financed by IM Global, and they chunked up about $30 million for this movie.
Oh, so. Interesting. The film name is Safe, and this is not a clever title in the least.
It's a very blunt title.
It is a film where, in the end, they're after a safe. One thing to say about this film is it's not clever. It's very straightforward. It is simply a vehicle for Jason Statham to kick people's asses. That's all it is, pretty much. A lot of very tired plot pieces used, things that you've seen all the time. There's nothing new in this film at all.
And folks, thank you very much for listening to me.
No, there are some good things to talk about in
sure.
it. But it doesn't get high marks on creativity. I will say that much.
You know what? I will say that it is the storytelling, the script writing is not inspired. But right. I do think that the directing of the film was very good.
Yes, the directing was very tight. The cinematography was nice. The fight scenes were very well choreographed.
Everything looked fantastic. And in terms of acting and storytelling, this movie doesn't really get a lot of kudos from me. But from a visual perspective, it was a lot of fun to watch.
Yes.
So,
but then there are also, it's important to note in this, tons and tons and tons of stereotypes.
Yes. Yes. It's as if the people who wrote the screenplay, I should have written their names down. I think
Yakin Boa, or Boaz Yakin was involved.
Yeah, I think he was. But I think, you know, it's like they sat down, they watched a Russian mob movie, and they watched a Hong Kong triad movie, and they said, we want to do this. And Lionsgate said, well, we won't send you to either Hong Kong or Moscow to film this. So they're like, well, fine, crap.
New Jersey, please.
We'll just do it in the back lot and make it look like New York City.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a lot of stereotypes here, from the triad gangsters having a casino underneath a dance hall to the Russian mobsters in their very fine oak paneled offices and everything like that. It just...
If you watch this film and you don't like what you saw, you're not satisfied. There are two films that came to mind for me that are very similar that do it so, so, so much better. Taken with Liam Neeson was one of them, and Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction is another one. Action films, in a sense, but so much more meat to them, actual plot involved. Very good films. Like I said, you know, Safe is a bunch of stuff you've already seen just kind of put together. But Jason Statham can fight.
He can. And he actually, I was doing a little research on this, he actually choreographs and performs all of his own stunts in every one of his movies.
That is actually impressive.
So it's very impressive. His actual physical acumen is quite impressive.
Huh. Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's start talking about the actual plot, what there is of it in this.
My favorite part of the movie is the first 6 minutes.
The first 6 minutes where it's present day, 1 hour earlier, 1 year ago, and then a fight.
It's
it's quick.
The amazing thing about the first 6 minutes of the movie is that it is a cornucopia of non-linear storytelling.
Yeah, and it was a little tough for me just because I was trying to figure out what's happening and how these things are interrelated.
I think it was one of those things where you just have to watch it, and then it clicks together at the end of the 6 minutes. You just let it wash over you, and then once it's done, you understand what you need to know for the rest of the movie.
And my problem is I was going into it with the mindset that I was going to really pick apart the plot and pay attention and figure out what's going on from the get-go and, you know, look for foreshadowing, blah, blah, blah. These things are not there.
You know,
so you do have to approach it as just watch it. If you're not catching in the very beginning what's going on, you're okay because you'll catch up real quick because it's not too much going on.
I would say that this is that the first 6 minutes of the movie are not the beginning of the first act. They are actually a prologue.
Yeah.
And in that sense, that is one of the few interesting structural things that this movie actually does, because you don't see prologues used very often. Or if you do, it's most often like in the James Bond format where they show you the prologue, which is an intense action scene that ends the last adventure. And then you have the opening credits, and then the movie begins.
Right. So there were a lot of things I kind of laughed at in mm-hmm. the film, in a sense. It wasn't so much what just happened on screen, but it was implications of what was happening on screen.
Yeah.
Such as the beginning starts out, they show you where Jason Statham comes from. He's a cage fighter. He accidentally put someone in the hospital that he wasn't supposed to. He was supposed to take a dive, and he's like, I just hit this guy once, and he just went down. I mean, you're fighting Jason Statham. Like, it only takes one punch, and he's gotcha.
Yeah.
So, they set up that, but then you see this young Chinese girl who's in China, and it's established that she's very good at math. Mm-hmm. She has kind of a photographic memory for numbers, and so she then ends up being taken, and she goes to the United States, and she's being held onto by this triad group.
And essentially the triad threatens her mother.
Yes.
And says, you will come with us or your mother will die.
Yeah, and they continually use that to keep her in check. To say, you better do this. Your mother's life depends on it.
Right.
So that's what they do. One of the most interesting things to me is when she's with this triad group, she goes into the office because she's summoned to come and memorize the safe code. I'm not even going to pull any punches. It's a friggin' safe code.
Yeah.
It's called safe. It's not clever.
Yeah.
And
she looks at it. She's able to memorize it. And the thing is that they write it in the middle of a whole bunch of other numbers trying to disguise it. But she tells him, well, it's interesting because she tells Statham's character, Luke Wright. His name is Luke Wright.
Yes.
She tells him at the beginning, well, there's either a 3 or a 7 before these particular numbers appear. So that, and he's like, oh, well, then that means that it's a safe code and it's how you turn either to the right or to the left.
Yeah, it's pretty hilarious the way he just
he's just like, oh, yeah, that's exactly
honestly,
what it is.
She tells him a few things about numbers and he's smarter than her all of a sudden and figures out everything immediately. It was ridiculous.
Yeah.
But that's not in the beginning. That's much later.
That's much later in the movie.
But one of the things that was funny to me is when she first shows up into the office of this triad group to memorize the safe code and all the numbers around it, they have, they're doing accounting for all the money they have. They don't use computers, they're using a giant abacus.
Yeah.
And it just kind of made me laugh to myself because I'm like, oh, here's this very powerful gangster group and they're using an abacus.
Well, if you think about it, that's very smart.
Exactly. Then that's what I started thinking. Go ahead.
So the thing is that if you have a computer, then if that computer is tied at all to the internet, anybody can find the information on that computer. It doesn't matter how secure it is. As we have learned over the past few months, the NSA can break into any computer. So it makes sense to keep your records on paper, locked up in a secure location, or in the mind of somebody who knows everything. So the
girl is the computer now.
Essentially, the girl is the Mentat who keeps everything locked away.
Yep.
And if you don't know, Mentat is a reference to Dune. Great movie, watch it. So they are using her as a way to store information that they don't want anybody else to know. And the great thing is that when they take her from China to New York, she still predominantly only speaks Chinese. So they're able to walk through the city with impunity because nobody understands what she's saying. And she's just able to rattle off all of the numbers whenever the triad leader in New York wants to hear them.
Yeah, and all the numbers include all the businesses that they're charging protection fees for, like what their income is and how much that means they should be taking from them, and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
And also, one thing that she's really great from, really great about, is that she's able to track, like, the decline and the rise of each business. So one of them that they have, like I mentioned before, is an underground casino.
Yep.
And so she points out quite effectively that the casino is actually bringing in less money than it should.
Yes.
So then, in typical stereotype triad fashion, the leader of the triad goes, beats the snot out of the casino manager, and then kills him.
Yeah, of course. And then one thing we end up seeing, you know, Luke Wright, Jason Statham's character, ends up coming into everything. And basically because he screwed over the Russian mob.
By accident, it seems.
Is also there. Yes, by accident, by beating that guy so bad that with one punch. They kill his wife. And we don't see that happen, but, you know, they talk about it after they've taken him to this random place and act like they're going to kill him.
Which makes no sense, because, I mean, the movie's already got an R rating. Why not just show the dead body?
Yeah. So at this point, I see some of the most unbelievable acting. Unbelievable as in you cannot believe that that's realistic. When they're talking about his dead wife, and he's just sitting there, basically, with... I mean, you can tell he's trying to muster the emotion, but it's just not happening.
You don't hire Jason Statham to emote.
Yeah.
You hire him to punch things.
To make other people emote.
To make other people emote in pain.
Yeah, exactly. So that really stood out to me as like, oh my God, his wife was killed and it seems like he doesn't really care that much.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not really going to say too much about that because there are plenty of action stars who cannot really work up a strong emotional feeling about anything. I would say that Sylvester Stallone definitely, yeah, you know, he has two modes. I shoot it or I punch it or I drive the race car, you know, and he doesn't really have a lot. Hey, Adrian, you know, even when he's talking about Adrian, who's apparently the love of his life, he doesn't really come across as very.
Yeah. It's just something that you have to accept.
Yeah. It's just something.
With this genre.
It's part of the action adventure genre that characters have a certain depth to their emotion, and it's only about 6 inches.
Yeah, so we start getting this kind of backstory to Luke Wright.
Yeah.
And then they say that, you know, anybody that you get close with is going to die from here on out, to basically ostracize him from everyone. So, you know, he's ostracized. He's got nothing.
So he pretty much decides, well, I'm going to be a homeless bum.
Yep.
I'm just going to drink alcohol and walk around New York City.
And that's what he does. He goes out and he's homeless. And the interesting thing about this is they start showing, like, it seems to me like it is kind of trying at that point to make a statement about how poorly homeless people are treated, because it's pretty bad.
The guards in the quote-unquote shelter are just, they're just ridiculous.
Yeah, the guards, the police officers who show up, they're very accusatory with everyone. They just treat them all as immediate scum. It's like they're in a prison already.
Yeah.
But one of the things that really stood out to me that you might not notice unless you really think, there are no homeless females.
No, it's all guys.
All males.
All guys.
And that's a stereotype.
It is something of a stereotype, but it also speaks a lot about how homeless shelters work in general, because they do try and actually segregate them.
Right, but you also, like, you see a lot of homeless people on the street,
That's true.
In the film, and they're never any females.
Well, you see them where they want you to see them. Once the action starts, you don't see a single hobo anywhere.
Well, yeah, because they run away from
right,
the fight,
exactly.
I guess. So that goes down, and you see that he can't get close with anyone.
Well, and there is a moment where they try to make Jason Statham act, by with the shoes.
Damn you!
Come on,
they prod
him with a stick. But apparently the last possessions that he has that are really nice, from his former life as a cage fighter, are a pair of sneakers. And so there's this guy in the homeless shelter who says, "Those are really nice shoes, man. I would do anything you want." Basically intimating that he's willing to do anything he wants.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And he this guy goes after Statham refuses, after Wright refuses, I'm sorry. Right.
Right.
And so he takes off his shoes and his feet are all bloody and they're rotting and it's just a horrible mess. And Wright just says, you know what, take the shoes. Just go see a doctor. That's all I want you to do. Right. Which was a nice moment, and with a more well-rounded actor, would have been a really nice character moment.
Yeah.
And so you can see that the script is trying for you to develop a certain amount of sympathy for Mr. Wright. But I mean, it really boils down to when can the punching start?
Yeah, and yeah. Yes, yes. When do the people around Statham become his punching bag?
Yeah. Something that I will point out as an incredibly huge plot point flaw is the fact that he's still going by his real name.
Yes.
You know, the character Luke Wright, apparently that is the name that he goes by in all of his endeavors, be it cage fighting, be it itinerant hoboing, be it police work, whatever it is. The only time he uses a nom de plume is when he steals somebody else's credit card.
Well, they and then he and his face ends up being recognized by the police
while he's homeless.
Yeah, and then you realize because they take him in and there's a group of police officers who are talking to him, not at the station, in an abandoned, looks like a parking garage.
Yeah,
and they're like, this is when it's established that he used to be a police officer. And he was involved in some shady business with these other police officers he's talking to at that point, where they would basically take money from these mobs, and the triad or the Russian mob, and do what they wanted them to do.
And this to me was the point where I kind of got a little frustrated with the movie, and this frustration continued on because there was a lot of splaining happening. Everything that you learn about the characters from this point on is all dialogue driven.
Yeah.
You know, it would have worked so much better if you had like a series of flashbacks here.
Yeah.
That starts when they go into the thing, into the garage, and say, look, dude, we didn't know that you were still in town. Get out of here, or you're persona non grata.
Yeah.
And then you see him like in a police uniform and doing things with these other cops. It would have established his relationship with the other cops much better at that
Instead,
point.
Instead, it's, Luke, we can't believe you're here. Remember when we all used to be scumbags together? Those were good times. Now we hate you.
Now we hate you because you betrayed us and became a scumbag for somebody else.
Yeah, exactly. But we're all scumbags. I mean, come on.
It's fun to be scumbags together.
Exactly. Why'd you ever leave our scumbag brotherhood? So then going forward is when you start seeing that the police are corrupt.
Yeah.
Surprise, surprise. Everyone's corrupt in this.
The mayor's corrupt. The cops are corrupt.
And I'm going to be honest. In this film, it seems like every single police officer in the entire state of New York is corrupt.
I'm going to have a hard time whenever I drive through New York now. Just going to be looking in the mirrors. Well, who do I have to bribe now?
Yeah, exactly. So there's an interesting moment where the police are going to have a raid on the Russian mob's, I guess it's their headquarters, I would assume.
Yeah.
And they're ready to fight, but then they call them and they say, look, you call your boys off, we'll pay you. And then this is where it's revealed the triad is paying these police officers to go after the Russian mob, and they're negotiating at this point. They're like, well, they're giving us this much money.
Yeah.
So the Russians are like, well, we'll give you 5% more than that. And then they're going back and forth.
They're
going
to give me 12%. What are you going to do?
Exactly. And it is like not just a SWAT team. It's like the entire department is there for this.
Yes.
And they're in on it. And it, to me, I was just like, wow, really? Every single police officer is dirty in this film? That's kind of crazy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and you could almost say that that's kind of a social commentary on the state of law enforcement in our country at this point.
Right.
I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, because I do think that there are people who get into law enforcement because they want to do good.
Oh, plenty.
Yeah, but I mean, there are people in law enforcement who do go into the job because they love the abuses of power.
True.
So I mean, it's unfortunate, but it is true.
Yeah.
You would like to think the best of these people, but to be honest, the fact that this kind of graft happens is a reality. In some, and with a police force as large as New York City's, it makes sense that it happened. It would it follows in a logical progression that it happens more than you would think.
So at this juncture, we then have the police officers find out about the little girl. Her name is May. May, M-E-I.
M-E-I, but it's pronounced May, yeah.
May, and they find out about her and how the Russians are like, hey, we want this girl because she has something that we want, and so they go after her. And then the police are looking for her because she gets away because the Russian mobsters ambush the triad and try and get her, and they kill everyone. But the girl runs away, and then while she's running away
while they're trying to make the graft negotiation.
Yeah.
The graft auction, as we'll call it.
And then they kind of abandon everything and go after the girl to find her. And this is when Luke Wright gets involved because he sees people chasing this young girl. And I don't know, how old do you think she is? Like 12?
She's 12, according to the Netflix.
Okay, there you go. She's 12 years old. She looks 12, so mm-hmm. I was able to guess that. That's good. They did a good job casting in that. So he sees that she's being chased, and all of a sudden he's like, well, I'm not a scumbag anymore, so I'm going to try and help this child out.
I'm going to do something that's right.
Luke Wright.
Yeah, the naming conventions here were a little on the nose. Because you had Wright, you had a cop who was dirty named Wolf.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was a little bit. Yeah.
It was a little too easy.
Yeah, we.
So he gets involved, and of course, it's time for ass kicking.
It is time for ass kicking, finally. But first, we must do an homage to a great, great action movie. The French Connection.
Yeah. Go ahead.
It's a train scene.
Yep.
And I'm not a huge fan of The French Connection. I actually think that it's a pretty worthless movie in general. But there is one scene where the officers are chasing a guy, and he jumps onto a train, and then they're driving under the train, and it's a very iconic piece of film history. Then at one point, if I remember correctly, they get on the train and they have to do all these acrobatics to get into the actual train.
Yeah.
And here we have Jason Statham essentially doing the same type of thing.
Yeah.
He jumps onto the end car and is riding the train on the roof for a while and, you know, trying to get through the doors, but some of the doors are locked and he can't. And I'm just sitting there going, really? French Connection?
But if there is one thing that this film does well, it's showcase the fighting skills of Luke Wright, Jason Statham.
And
they are impressive.
They are very impressive. And I do not want to get him mad in real life.
No. And I will say there was a kind of funny little quip
mm-hmm.
where on the train he ends up shooting and killing someone. And everyone around, all the innocent bystanders are in shock.
They're shocked. And,
he looks at him and he says, don't lose sleep. He had it coming.
Yeah.
That was actually kind of funny.
That was kind of funny. Started. Yeah. And then he just kept on going. At this point, he's kind of entered Terminator mode. The nice thing is, I will say this about the subway as a fight scene location. It is great for the protagonist, and you know, you see this in Spider-Man, and you see this in any movie, cop movie at one point or another. The cop genre is just chock filled with these. I remember there was a fight scene on a subway train in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So, I mean, this is something that is kind of ubiquitous.
Yeah.
Having a fight on a New York subway is kind of the thing to do.
So then the film erupts
into
just fight after fight after fight, pretty much, with not a whole lot of plot going on. And the interesting thing is a lot of these fights are going on in very public places, like the train, and in the streets, you know, in a crowded restaurant, all these things.
And then there's like a Mexico City-style grab for the girl at one point where they just like slam their cars in front of the triad, start pulling out the guns, and in broad daylight just start shooting, trying to get the girl.
And it made me start thinking about how brazen all of this criminal activity is in the film. And I started thinking this dealing with the police, you know, when they were showing the bidding going back and forth, that is what the screenwriter used to be like, how can I have these grand fights that are just going to be cool out in the streets and in crowded restaurants and all this? Oh, I'll have the police be totally corrupt.
Right.
Because then I can do whatever I want.
Right.
I can have fight scene anywhere. I can have it with police helicopters in the air, and these guys are just hanging from wires. Yeah. I mean...
Yeah.
So that's just a vehicle to allow anything fight-wise in the film.
It is nice to see, though, that Luke Wright does have a lot of situational awareness. Like, while he is demolishing the mooks that are thrown at him. Like, one of my favorite little takeaway moments in the entire fight montage that lasts about 20 minutes was when he's running through the subway and there's a B cop who's looking for the girl, and he's got the radio attached to his shirt, and he hears the call for where the girl was last sighted, and where the gangsters are, and he just takes off and goes to where that radio was. I mean, that's really great situational awareness that he's able to pick that up on the spot and immediately change his plans to meet that particular need.
And one thing that I really liked amongst the fighting was also a situational thing where he eventually goes into a restaurant to meet the Russian mobsters.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's trying to do like a double cross thing between the triad and the mobsters, and actually the police as well, because they're all corrupt.
Triple cross.
Yeah. And so he goes in to this restaurant and pretty much immediately starts fighting. And one of the great things he does is there are some of the Russian mobsters sitting at a table, and he jumps over, flips the table up, smashes them against the wall with the table, and then shoots through the table.
Yeah.
And that was probably the coolest part. I mean, very inventive use of the environment there and fighting awareness. And it was cool, I will say.
The action genre is meant to be a showcase for excellent cinematic techniques. And Boaz Yakim has that down. I mean, you can tell from every shot choice, every angle that he puts the camera, you know, where he has Statham on the screen, that he knows his craft down.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, he's done Havana Nights too. I mean, Dirty Dancing too. But that does, you know, sometimes you do a movie because it's in your contract.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what you have to do to fulfill the thing. But I mean, one of my favorite shots from the movie in terms of showing an action film in an artistic way was when they were having the fight scene in the car. They were jockeying with each other for position and everything. Instead of showing Wright looking backwards over his shoulder to see where they're going, he just looks up into the mirror, and you get the shot of the car, and it's so detailed in the rearview mirror that the camera is able to pick everything up from that particular angle, which is a fantastic shot, because unless they use like CGI or something to kind of insert that in, you know, you would have seen the cameraman directly in the back seat.
Yeah.
You know, so the fact that they were able to get the angle just right so you could see the car behind them without seeing the cameraman was a really good directing technique to give you a more, we'll say, claustrophobic feel for the fight, which is what you wanted in a extreme car chase like it was.
And one thing that I think is really, really important to point out about action films is that, you know, some people will just pass it off, and a lot of times I will, and just be like, oh, it's an action film, there's really not a whole lot to it.
Yes.
Yes, it's usually light on the plot, which is what I really look for in films. But you really have to realize how much work goes into those fight scenes. Because that's really tough physical work.
Yeah.
And how many takes do you have to make?
Well, I mean, like, if you think about it, a typical movie to film of that length takes about anywhere from 21 to 60 days to film. So that is a lot of fighting. And right. Typically, like, directors, they don't work on the Ed Wood style of one shot and you're done.
Right.
It's typically
numerous.
It's typically 8 to 12.
You're right.
Shots of a scene, and then they take whatever they consider is the best.
And you need to think that it's not only tough for the people who are acting in these scenes, but it's tough for the cameraman and the director, because things move so fast
yeah.
in those that you need to get the timing and the shot, like whether it's going to be close up or wide or whatever, and the movement, pretty much perfect
yeah.
in order to get everything in the scene that's moving so fast that you need for that film.
And this is something where filmmakers study Hitchcock for in great detail, because he perfected the use of the storyboard to get all of the angles down properly.
Yeah.
You know, and to think, you know, something that we just think of as, oh yeah, it's an action movie, generic shoot up and everything like that. It's amazing how much actual process work goes in to make something that we consider to be popcorn fluff.
Yeah.
Because they have to know the exact angles of everything. They also have to know like technical details about the vehicles. Where are the crumple zones for this particular car? Where can we hit this one to make it look realistic but not harm the actors or the stunt doubles inside it? You know, it's amazing how much actually goes into an action film to make it exciting and enjoyable for the viewer.
And that's why it's so expensive. I mean, what do you say, like $30
million? $30 million.
Yeah.
Which, ironically enough, was a plot point of the movie.
Yeah, yeah, $30 million was what was in the one safe.
Yeah.
Yeah, very true. So after all the fighting goes down in the restaurant, Luke Wright calls the head Russian mobster and basically says, "Hey, I dispatched of all your cronies here.
And I have your son."
Yeah, and I've got your son right now, and he has him, you know, bound and put in the trunk of a car.
I think the quote was, "I'm going to treat him like a very poorly treated pet."
Yeah, yeah. So then this guy tries to offer Luke Wright a deal.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. Of course Luke's not going to take it because we have, I don't know, a half an hour left in the movie or something.
Right.
And he's got to kick more ass.
A lot more ass.
He has to.
It's in the contract.
Exactly. And that's one of the interesting things, and I do this with TV shows too. When something's coming up that could potentially end a TV show or a film, I will a lot of times just look at how much time is left in it, and I'll be like, oh yeah, it's not ending here, so this
yeah.
is not happening.
Yeah, it's not ending, so they're safe.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, and that's something that's easy to do because, you know, if you pause the movie on Netflix, it's going to flash up with how much time is left on the actual movie. So a lot of times, and this happened with me, I paused the movie at one point and it's like at 15 minutes, I'm like, well, that's enough time for at least three more fight scenes. I mean,
what else is coming?
So what else is coming? Well, fighting and more fighting.
Yeah. So then after this, Luke is going to set up this triple cross. So he gets in contact with his former scumbag buddies in the police department, his core group of former scumbag buddies, and he basically says, look, there's $30 million in this safe. I'll give each of you $5 million if you come in and bust some heads, well, kill people.
Yeah.
And, you know, we open the safe and then we're on our way, whatever. But before he tells them this, one of the, a good comedic moment in it is they immediately, when he meets up with them, they hand him a small paper bag, brown paper bag.
And you think it's like drugs or something.
I thought it was going to be a stack of money for whatever reason. And he opens it up and pours it out and it's a hoagie. It's a sandwich. And he's like, what did you think it was? I'm hungry. I haven't eaten all day. Which is funny and interesting because it points out how in, especially films like this, you don't see them ever take time to go to the bathroom, eat food, sleep. They're just kicking ass 24/7.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that was kind of, I think, a nod to, you don't ever see this, so I'm just going to kind of throw it in there to be like, haha, it's kind of funny. Nobody ever sees this.
No one ever sees this.
So
then he makes love to this hoagie for about 45 seconds.
Best sandwich he ever
had. It was the best sandwich he had ever had.
It's like it's worth $30 million.
Which is incredible because, you know, if you look at what he was going through before he got the sandwich, he had stolen a Russian mobster's credit card. He was staying in a five-star hotel. He could have had any food he wanted to delivered
Hobie,
room
man.
Service, and he didn't do any of that. He didn't even get food for the girl.
It was from a specific place, Scarnetti's, I think is what it was called.
I didn't catch that.
I think that's what he said. Then we do have an obligatory scene, but is usually pretty cool, and it is cool in this case. The getting ready to get into a firefight montage, where people are getting their guns ready, putting their gear on, and all that stuff. It is always cool to see that. And all these scumbag police officers go through that.
In their suits, they've got like...
Yeah. And they look cool.
They
and
do.
It's cool. But then they go into this Asian nightclub and no tact whatsoever.
Rather than going, shooting. Police or something, they just hold up a gun and just shoot into the ceiling.
Shoot in the air and then they start shooting random people.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, wow, you guys just don't care, do you?
Well, we are corrupt cops and we do what we want. I mean,
not only are they corrupt cops, but they have zero conscience.
Yeah.
Zero. They're zero like, I'll conscience. Kill anyone. I don't care. $5 million? All right. don't even need to kill this person. I'm going to do it.
I think part of it was, you know, when you have the mayor in your pocket, as one of the corrupt cops tells the mayor at one scene, hey, I'm pretty much the reason that you're the mayor at this point. So you do what I say. And the mayor's like, excuse me, no, you do what I say because I'm your mayor. It's like, if you have that much impunity and that much power over authority, well, then you can pretty much walk all over wherever you want to do whatever the hell it is you want. I mean, it's the same mentality as the Third World Warlord.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's written in there, basically, you can read into it, that these police officers have been corrupt for a long time.
A very long time.
Long, long, long time. So their blood is like ice.
Yeah.
And you definitely see that, whether it's intentional or not, when they're in the nightclub fighting and a bunch of these police officers get killed.
Yeah.
And then there's just the one guy left, mainly, and he just does not care at all that his friends are dead.
Yeah.
Like, nothing. Absolutely nothing. It's like, oh, that guy's dead. Whatever, more money for me.
Yeah, and he basically walks out of the casino holding all the money in a bag with Statham next to him. And another cop meets him and he goes, do you need any help? And he's like, no, dead body's in there. And then just throws the money into a car and gets in and drives away.
Hey, all my friends of 30 years are dead in there. Just get them in body bags. Yeah. I do not care.
I don't care one bit.
And, you know, I understand what type of film it is, and I understand that these guys are bad guys, but at the same time, can we have a little bit of realism?
Well, I mean, the thing is, even if you're a villain, most of the time, you think that your actions are justified one way or another.
Yeah, but you also have an affinity for somebody.
Right, right. You have, but what I'm saying is, you have connections, you believe that you are right. So, I mean, Darth Vader, bringing up Star Wars again. No, but Darth Vader honestly believed that he was doing the right thing.
Yeah.
You know, by supporting the Emperor, by turning to the dark side, he was trying to save his wife, you know, from dying, because he was mortally afraid of losing her. So, you hear that the path to hell is paved with good intentions. A lot of the time, that's true. You don't see this here. It's like, yeah, we're bad. We know it. We love it. And we're just going to embrace it.
There's another person who thought they were doing the right thing. And that was Hitler. The only reason I brought that up is because the other podcast where we were talking about how it's so ridiculous when people bring that up.
Yes,
I wanted to see how I could get you to react.
Well, I hope I reacted in the way that you wanted.
Yeah, so these cops are cold.
Oh, they're cold.
So whatever. But, you know, Luke Wright screws this final cop over. He shoots him in the arm. He's like, you're not going to die.
Oh, you're fine.
I'm in control here, and you're going to do what I tell you, and you're not getting any money at the moment.
Right.
But he does promise him some money. So, you know, Luke, he's not a terrible guy to these people.
You know, the thing is that the crime of Luke Wright in the eyes of these cops is that he develops a conscience, apparently.
yeah.
Apparently.
It's like, but this guy, I got a soft spot for this guy.
Yeah. But, I mean, one of the things that I was hoping would be interesting about the movie was his interactions with May.
Yeah.
And, you know.
They're not.
And part of the problem is that Chan, I'm sure she's going to grow up to be a better actress than she is today.
Mm-hmm.
But she essentially reminded me of Jake Lloyd
as
Anakin Skywalker in The Phantom Menace. Could not deliver a line in English to save her life.
I will say something about... Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, and her Chinese seemed a little stilted to me, too.
Yeah. One of the interesting things about her character, though, is she has this kind of fatherly figure within the triad who actually
seems to like her a lot.
Right. You can tell he is kind of trying to look out for her, in a sense. Probably because she's been with him the whole time, and it's been said, you know, this is your tag-along, you have to have her with you at all times. So he's kind of, you know, formed a little bit of an affinity for her. And at one point, he gets killed.
Yeah.
And you can tell that she feels a little bit of something toward him, you know, even though that's her captor.
The interesting thing about that was, this guy is taking care of her. He has her with him all the time. She's basically his laptop computer for crime knowledge. They're just on a daily basis together all the time. And when the hit happens and Russians are trying to kidnap her, what he does is he's like, well, we got to wipe the hard drive. So he pulls out a gun and puts it to her head and is about to pull the trigger when he actually gets shot. He's not killed at that point, but he is shot.
Right.
And later on in the movie, somehow they get back together. And he says, I hope you realize that it wasn't personal. And she's like, yeah, I know, it was just business.
Yeah, and there's this theme of him trying to, quote, teach her business throughout it. And it's mob business. Which is, it's, you gotta kill people.
How to kill people and yeah. not have a bad conscience about
exactly.
it.
And so, with the Triple Cross ordeal going down, Luke Wright ends up paying a visit to the mayor and lets him know... Oh, wait, does he contact his buddy Alex first? Quote, buddy.
Quote-unquote buddy.
I can't remember in what order that was.
It all blends together. It really doesn't matter.
Okay. So he at some point pays a visit to the mayor. And he gets a disc that kind of shows where the money came from him.
Yeah.
And it's obviously very dirty money. So he then has to deal with this guy's lover. It's a gay guy.
Let's go ahead and talk about this particular stereotype.
The only homosexual in the film is very, very, very evil.
Well, I mean,
why?
It's not just the... I think Alex and the mayor are actually a real couple.
In the context of the film,
you know, because Alex tells Wright, yeah, we're going to use this money, $30 million, to buy a villa in Bali.
Yes.
And then we're just going to live our lives happily together. Basically, they want the fairy tale ending to this story of the Mad Prince and his corruption. And it's irksome to see a movie like this where the only thing that you know about this character who is supposed to be evil is that they are a particular minority, you know, and it doesn't matter what movie it is, considering the fact that Yakim made Remember the Titans, which is a movie about school integration and the coming together of a black school and a white school bonding over high school football in Virginia times, to then turn around and use another minority as a whipping boy is really kind of disturbing.
Yeah, it is. And it was very pointless. And it like you said, it's irksome.
Yeah.
It definitely is. But, you know, that aside, this character is also a badass when it comes to fighting.
I wish we could see more of that.
He's a cold-blooded killer, and he's a badass. And so basically, Luke talks to him and says, this is a deal. I've got all the dirt on you. You're not going to get any of this money. I need that girl. Because the girl is now in the hands of the Russians. And he wants her back, because now he cares about her. He doesn't want to see her getting hurt.
Yeah.
So this guy, Alex, is like, okay, whatever, I'll get her for you. So he shows up and he's supposed to have this deal with the Russians, and then instead he just kills them.
Mm-hmm.
And then May was taken with her father figure, Triad. And so this guy, Alex, kills all these people in front of her.
Yeah.
And then he's about to kill the Triad guy, and he says to her, you might want to turn away for this.
And she's like, yeah.
And then he snaps the guy's neck. But the funny thing to me in that was, he just killed a ton of people in front of this kid.
Yeah.
And then there's one person, and he's like, oh, you might want to look away on this one. But he has no context. He does not know the relationship between those two.
Right.
So either that was bad writing, like they kind of forgot that when they were writing it, or it's just ridiculous because you can kill X amount of people, but once you kill someone of the same minority in front of the child, then it could be a problem. It might scar her.
Yeah. Another thing that's hinted at in the film but is not really well developed is the idea that the mayor, Alex, and Luke Wright have a long and involved history with each other.
Yeah, and there's nothing said about it.
And there's nothing that's said about it. It's just like, oh, hey, Luke, you remember how I got you on that special task force? Well, now you should do whatever I say.
Yeah.
You know, and then Alex is like, hey, Luke, old buddy, old pal, I'll give you the girl if you die. You know, I mean, it's intimated that there is this relationship that's there, but there's no on-screen chemistry because, frankly, none of the actors have any kind of chemistry, except for the mayor, who we talked about earlier as, you know, Humperdinck and Edward Skellington and everything. He's a fantastic actor. But, you know, it's just like, really? You can't throw like another 30-second nonlinear flashback sequence just to kind of give you a shorthand idea rather than just vomit exposition all over the place, you know? And to me, that's why the first 6 minutes of the movie were the most interesting, was because all of this information was given to you so quickly. Like you said, it was a little hard to digest, but it was far more entertaining than watching some people talk.
Yeah, I agree. One thing I wanted to bring up real quick is the idea of the stereotypes with the mobs, especially the Triad, how they were like, it seemed to me like it was like, okay, well, we have to have a Chinese component in one of the mobs because we want Jason Statham to do martial arts and we want to fight it, have him fight against someone who knows martial arts.
Right.
Because all Chinese people know martial arts, apparently.
And all Chinese gangsters know martial arts.
I mean, that was another thing that really kind of irked me about it. It's like, stereotype, please don't do this. Please.
No.
And you know, it's one of those things where you look at the martial arts and it's fun. It's fun to watch and it's visually entertaining, but it's not culturally true.
Right.
You know, and Hong Kong has this great, rich history and vibrancy. And like, if you watch movies like Election, which is a true triad crime movie, there's like little to no violence at all in the entire movie. Until the very end of it, when the guy who wins the election forms a fake alliance to get his contender who was trying to run against him to be his friend, and then he drowns the guy in a river. And it's not anything that's slick and stylized in martial arts. It's him like beating this guy's head in with a rock and then finishing the job by sticking his head into a river.
Yeah.
It's very brutal. It's not at all what you would think of as martial artsy or anything like that. And it's frankly a more impactful movie than this was.
Yeah. But I will say that there was something interesting that happened in the very end of Safe. And that was Luke had to fight Alex with May there because he, you know, wanted to get May. And of course, Alex is such a terrible person, he's not going to just hand the kid over.
Right.
So they fight, you know, they have this big, you know, end boss fight.
Yeah.
And then May helps out. She picks up a gun and shoots Alex.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like she goes from being the brain pinata for Alex to being like Indiana Jones.
Yeah, and so the interesting thing about that, though, was that that's her showing that she learned
business.
She truly learned business, and she took her first step and killed someone. So not only that, but she then sends a handwritten letter to the head of the triad saying, you know, we have the money, I'm free, I know what you did, blah, blah, blah. Basically, you're not safe. You better just go back to China, in essence.
And he does. And he just walks away. And the great thing, though, is that they run off, like, 5 copies of the discs, and then they just leave them in safe deposit box throughout the town of New York, you know, just to provide a little insurance for themselves.
And the interesting thing I also wanted to point out is, within the context of this film, Luke Wright is not a good person.
No.
He, too, is a scumbag, has done scumbag things, continues to do scumbag things. He's killing people, whether, you know, like, whether it's vigilante justified or not, he's killing people.
Yeah.
So, it's kind of crappy in a film like this that the bad guy's bad himself.
Yeah.
And they're just like, I'm rooting for a terrible person, but I think he's good because everyone else is worse.
I think Statham is pretty much known for playing the anti-hero, so that's not terribly against his type.
Yeah.
The thing that interested me about Wright in all of this story is that he is the complication. He is not a hero. He's a complication. And he's actually,
right. He's
the wrench that gets thrown into other people's plans. Which was a cool way to look at it from a narrative point of view.
Yeah.
But wasn't done effectively enough to really hold my interest.
All right.
So I think this is now time for us to discuss our ideas and our final thoughts for the movie.
I think we covered this pretty well.
Yeah.
Would you like me to take the lead?
Go ahead.
So overall, as we said it, you know, this isn't a film that's rich in plot. It is, and a lot of the plot points that it has are very tired and have been done much better in many other films. But the fight scenes are very well put together. There are some glimpses of cool moments in the film, like some funny moments and some interesting things, like with May in the very end.
Yeah.
The stereotypes are irksome, but the camera work is great. The directing is really good. The cinematography looks really nice. The music is appropriate. I mean, there are a lot of good things that they did from a technical standpoint. This isn't a film that I'd be wanting to go back to see. I'm going to give it 2 stars, and the only reason I'm giving it 2 stars is because I gave 1.5 to The Hunger Games, and I'd rather watch Safe again than The Hunger Games again. So 2 stars for me.
Okay. One thing I did want to mention about the music was that it was a bit of a pastiche of the action movie soundtrack. Even to a point where May is hiding behind a dumpster at one point in the movie, and it sounds like the Mission Impossible thing. It really does.
I remember that.
So, I mean, the music is pretty good at some points, but again, there's nothing original about the actual soundtrack.
Yeah.
But I thought it was a decent directing job, but the script relies too much on the audience's previous exposure to heist and gangster films and shorthands major plot points. It's a shame that the flashback technique of the prologues wasn't kept through the rest of the movie. There's a lot of explaining that makes the overall delivery of the film dull. It is too straightforward with no truly exciting plot choices made. All told, this film is a comfortable watch for the mainstream audience that won't stretch their preconceived notions of what should go into an action movie. All in all, Safe lives down to its name. 2.5 stars.
2.5. So, for the podcast, 2.25 stars for our stamp. I would say that, you know, this is a film we would encourage people to watch if you really like just straight up action films.
Yeah.
If you just feel like vegging out to a film that you don't have to do any thinking about and you want to see some cool fight scenes, Jason Statham whipping some ass because he does it very well.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I would add as a recommendation for other films to watch that are in this, that are similar to this in genre, are Election, that I just mentioned, which is a fantastic Hong Kong film.
The Departed.
The Departed would be a great one. And also Sexy Beast.
Okay, haven't seen it.
Sexy Beast is all about breaking into a safe. It's a heist movie that is very claustrophobic and feels, is Ben Kingsley has an amazing performance. And as we've probably mentioned off this off air before, I don't really like Ben Kingsley. So for me to say that this is a good performance is really saying something. So those are some recommendations for movies that you could watch. And that pretty much wraps up this episode of Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night.
Thank you for joining us, everyone. We look forward to the next episode. And this was great, having an actual audience pick. So please send us more.
Absolutely. We've got some picks already that you have sent in. But we're always looking for more films. And the way that we get more variety, because I definitely have a style of movie that I like. And Carlin definitely has a style that he likes. So to keep us from going back to the well of what we enjoy, we do highly recommend that you go ahead and send us whatever reviews you want to do.
And until next time, thank you and keep watching films.
Absolutely. I hope you have a great evening.
You've been listening to Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night.
Our theme music was provided by Sweet Wave Audio. To find more royalty-free music for your own projects, check out sweetwaveaudio.co.uk.
And special thanks to Ariana Ramos for her graphic design savvy helping us with our album art.
Visit our website at mostexcellentmovienight.com to listen to other episodes, give us your opinion, and share with us other movies you'd like to have reviewed.
You can also contact us through our email address, mostexcellentmovienight@gmail.com. We would love to read them on the air.
Also, if you could rate and review the podcast on iTunes, we would be your friends for life.
For sure. That's all for now. Thanks for listening to Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night,
where movies are most excellent.
This has been a Nerd Circle podcast production.